Thank you. Hi, everyone. My name is Reese. I'm an alcoholic. What a great group. I forget how amazing this group is and what the positive energy and the support. Like, I don't know most people in here, but I feel supported, you know? And I want to congratulate all the token takers. It's my favorite part of any meeting. And we're all miracles. The fact that we're sitting here on a Saturday night instead of out there doing whatever we do is a miracle in my book. And so I was a late bloomer, you know. I always get jealous when I hear the people come in super, super young, and I'm like, man, I didn't start until I was almost 20. But it's interesting because by the time I did finally take my first substance, I like what Johnny said. He was like, I'm an alcoholic with a drug problem. I think that's what he said. That's me. And I'm grateful for that today. I am grateful for the drugs in my life. I believe it got me here so much faster. So thank you, cocaine. So by the time I was almost 20 years old, you know, the wheels had fallen off and I hadn't even had a drink. I was emotionally destroyed by my mind. I couldn't stand who I was. I couldn't stand anybody else. I was completely disconnected from life. I was disconnected from me. I didn't want to be me. And there was nothing positive. I'm sure there was something positive in my life, but I was tunnel vision. I just saw the darkness. That was all I was able to do at that point. I had no tools. I didn't know I needed God. I didn't know that I needed you. I hadn't even had a drink yet. I didn't know that I needed community. And that's what I feel here tonight. You guys are a really strong, cohesive community. And this is what saves our lives. These rooms save our lives. It saved my life. And so anyway, one day, No, let's back up. So let's rewind, and I'm going to tell you how I got to the place I was at before I had my first substance, because my first substance actually was not alcohol. So I was raised in Seattle, Washington by a single mother, and I have an older brother. And from the time I was really young, I wanted to be just like my brother. My mom was always sick. She suffered from chronic migraines and depression and who knows what else. She's never been diagnosed. So the house felt dark. The house always felt dark. And I knew immediately when I was young, and this is just in retrospect, looking back, I didn't want to be a girl because there was my representation, and I didn't want that. So I gravitated to my brother because he was strong and he was fast and all the kids liked him and I wanted to be just like him, but he was a typical older brother. And any older brother out here knows exactly what I'm going to talk about right now. You are mean to your younger siblings. I was stupid, and I was never going to be as cool as him. And the problem was I'm so sensitive. I'm very sensitive. And I took everything he said to heart. And so it just made me try harder to be tougher and to be, you know, more like him. And so by the time I was 9 years old, I was just a raging tomboy. I got all his hand-me-down tough skins. Some of you older people will know what those are. Tough skins are like Levi's on steroids. If you put tough skins, you put them up, they will stand. They are so thick. So I had his hand-me-down tough skins. I used to wear his wife beaters, and it's so funny. I was good with that. You know, I was good with who I was at that point. So one day, this is kind of what my mom did. One day, she decides that she's going to go visit my dad in Irvine, California. So I knew who my dad was. We'd visit him in summer sometimes. But we weren't really close. And my dad is very old school Latino. And some of you Latinos in here are going to know that the kind of girl that I was with my father, there was always conflict. So my mom goes to visit him. She comes back. Now, mind you, she left him when I was 3 months old. She comes back from this trip, and she's like, we're moving down to Irvine to be with your dad. So we up and left everything I knew in Seattle and went down to Irvine. And at the time, now it's really funny because I never looked at myself in terms of my race before. Most of you look at me and I look white. But I'm half Mexican. And when we moved to Irvine, we were the only mixed family in the neighborhood that we moved to. So instantly, I felt different. I felt, I was embarrassed to be seen with my dad. He was this very tall Latino man. He drove a black Cadillac, and he always had these three-piece suits on. And I wanted him desperately to love me, but I was blonde, and I was ashamed to be seen with it. So I was really, really conflicted. It was very, very confusing at that time. And my dad just wanted me to be a girl. He wanted me to be quiet and dress feminine and be, you know, don't talk back and don't be loud and no, you can't do what your brother does. And my whole life was turned upside down. And the kids called me names in school, and I started to hate everybody, and especially myself. Especially myself. And by the time I was 13, my mom one day, again, this is what she does, she says, we're moving back to Seattle without your dad. So she goes back to get a job, and she leaves me and my brother with my dad for a month. I had a younger sister, half-sister, who was the perfect girl. She was very feminine. She got to sit in the front seat with dad. He held her hand. Her nickname was Little Chicky, and mine was Little Shit. I'm not kidding. And during that month that my mom was gone, my dad didn't speak to me at all. And he didn't stay at home. And my sister was there, and they would leave, and they'd walk down the stairs holding each other's hand, and I'd run, and can I go? And he never turned around. And I can remember curling up in the corner of my parents' bedroom, sobbing, just feeling like it was my fault. If I was just a better girl, if I was just better, if I was just different, it was brutal. So we moved back to Seattle, and the only place my mom can afford is the south end of Seattle. The south end of Seattle is primarily black and Asian. So all of a sudden, I'm Goldilocks, and I'm white girl, it was so difficult being me. And you know, people always say, what are you? What are you? What are you? And, you know, I hope that today it's a little bit better for a lot of us mixed race people out there, you know, because there's so many of us. But at the time, because I'm old. At the time, there didn't seem to be a lot of us, at least in the places I lived. So there I was 13 years old. I hated everybody. Hated myself. I was furious with my mother. I was 13 years old, and I was tired of caretaking my mother again because she was always sick. So I was always watching for her tells to tell me that she was going to be sick. I was hyper vigilant of my mother's stuff. And one day, this is what I call my first drink because it was my first escape from my mind. My first escape was rage. And one day I just flew into a rage. I cussed, I broke things, I threw things, and I felt amazing. It was amazing to not care about anything, to not worry about what anybody thought, it was amazing. And of course, kind of like alcohol, the come down, not so good. You know, the remorse, the shame, the regret, the guilt, all of that. But I had found something that worked for me. And so I grabbed hold of that rage, and I displayed it as much as I possibly could, because if I didn't, I felt I was going to die inside. And so my brother starts drinking and using in high school, and why would you ever do that? You look so stupid. And he'd throw up at sometimes, and we'd have to quietly clean up after him. And why would anybody do this? He'd smoke weed, and he'd just be so stupid, you know? So I told myself, I'm never going to do those things. I'm never going to be like him. Well, so what happened is I found my next escape. My next escape was boys. And all of a sudden I realized this is what I've been missing. This is what I've been missing from my life. The love, the attention, the, you know, all that stuff. And because I didn't grow up in a household that we didn't hug. It wasn't affectionate like that. And so I really believed, okay, now maybe I'll be okay. So the voice in the head quiets a little bit. The feelings chill out a little bit. And I'm like, okay, this is it. This is what I've been missing. Well, Brad, my first boyfriend, he was mixed race too. And so that was cool. It's like, you know, this is where I belong. This is where I fit. But it didn't take long for me to realize that we had a very interesting relationship. So my brother and I, we were violent. I mean, we were latchkey kids. We were alone a lot. And we fought constantly. And I knew my brother loved me, but so violence was a part of love for me. So this relationship, when things started happening, and I was a participant, it wasn't something out of the ordinary. You know, this is how relationships are. But by the time I was 19, it had gotten really bad. I'd ran away from home. I managed to graduate high school, which is a miracle. And I managed to hide so much of my emotional trauma, so much of my stuff. I hid it. I was an excellent student. I was a teacher's aide in math. I was in the special choir. I was in the drama club. I was all these things. But inside, I was so lost. I was so completely lost. And so, 19 years old, I leave this relationship. And I run into the arms of the first person who's nice to me. And I'm like, okay. This has to be it. His name is Smiley. And Smiley was Chicano. And Smiley was part of this lowrider gang. And all of a sudden, I started talking like this. And I was cool. You know, he wore the Stacy Adams and the long zoot suit jackets. And the whole group was so cool. And I felt accepted. But it wasn't long, probably a few months before I realized their days when they were just getting started when I was going to bed. And it wasn't long after we were at this party and we were having so much fun. And the girlfriend of his best friend invites me into the bathroom. Now, she was like the perfect girl. She was beautiful. She was super feminine. I was not feminine. But she was so amazing to me, and so I wanted to be like her. We go in the bathroom, and she says, "You got to try this. It'll make you feel better. It'll make everything better." And it was a bullet for some of you who don't know what that is. It's cocaine and a little bullet. And so I did that, and of course I did not get that sense of ease and comfort that we get from drinking. But what I did get is I got this beautiful blanket of numbness, of silence. The voice quieted, the emotions were numbed out, and I realized this is what I've been missing. This is what I've been missing. And so I went full board to get as much of that and to stay absent from myself as much as I possibly could. And of course, good little budding alcoholic that I was, Smiley happened to be the local drug dealer. So within 2 years, I was completely strung out, and I blamed Smiley because I had no self-awareness. You know, as smart as we are, as smart as I was, I had no self-awareness. And I blamed everybody else and the world and circumstance for my problems. I could take no responsibility. And I think that's it's one of my main problems before I got sober, is until I could connect with my problem and take responsibility, I was never gonna have a chance at getting sober and staying sober. Because it's called growing up, you know? It's called growing up. So there I was, strung out, blamed him, left him, went back to my mom, but now I'm not loaded. And during that time, I started drinking alcoholically. See, I was never one of these who gradually got into my disease. It was all or nothing. That's the way I've always operated. All or nothing. And so I stopped doing everything, moved back in with my mom. That voice comes back. And that voice is louder than ever. And I feel terrible about myself. And it's always, you know, you're never going to amount to anything. And you just negative, 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 negative. And then the feelings, again, because I'm so sensitive, are so powerful that I just want to disappear. I am so desperate to not be here. So I go back to college because I loved school. I did well in school. So I'm like, okay, I'm going to go back to college. And pretty soon I meet Elliot. He's the preppy white boy. And I'm like, maybe this is it. And then there was Mamoon, and he was the African whose group, they were so much different than the other group I just left because they smoked spliffs and they were super chill. And then one day I realized, okay, it's the boys that are destroying my life. And it's really interesting because I could make a decision, you know, I could make a decision and then take another track. And so I'm like, I need a girlfriend. And so I immediately went to downtown Seattle to the Pike Place Market where all the cool people hang out. The musicians, the artists, all the really interesting folk hang out at the Pike Place Market. And of course I found her. Eva Ruma from Venezuela. And Eva Ruma was a street musician, and she was super talented, and she played guitar, she wore these cool hats that she painted, and she was just so cool, and I immediately knew, I'm getting her, this is it. Well, yes, that happened, and within a few weeks, we were hanging out. Not long after that, I'd been working a little coffee shop, quit my job, because I'd been stealing from the register, stopped going to school, left home, and we were on the streets of Seattle. Me and Eva Ruma from Venezuela. And I realized, pretty short period of time, that she's probably the worst addict that I'd ever been with. But by then, it was too late. It was too late. I was enamored with the lifestyle. It was dangerous. My mom said I left her notes sometimes, telling her it's just like a movie. And it's so interesting how alcoholism lies to us. Right? Alcoholism lies to us. And it was telling my mom that I was having a good time. And yes, there were moments. There were moments. But ultimately, again, because I'm all or nothing, I'm on the street and it's bad. So over the next few years, I'm in and out of jail. I'm in and out of the psych ward. I'm in and out of the hospital. The rapes, the beatings, the asking bums on Skid Row, well, I was a bum too, but asking fellow bums on Skid Row for a drink after 2 a.m. Sometimes, I lived like an animal sometimes, crawling under bushes when no one was looking to pass out so people couldn't do something to me when I was asleep because I'd be up for weeks. And that's how I lived. But as long as I could stay absent from my mind and my feelings, I was willing to do anything. That's all that mattered. And I lived like this. And it wasn't living, obviously. It was existing. It was existing. And I wanted to die. I wanted to die. But I didn't want someone else to kill me. I would sometimes smoke so much crack, I'd be like praying for my heart to explode. And I had a heart attack at 23. And, you know, but I couldn't die. And I know now why I couldn't die, because I was supposed to be here tonight sharing my story with you. So I'd been in and out of recovery, but I was young. And I was like, I'd look at everybody, you know, again, our disease can I swear? It's an asshole. Like, our disease is an asshole. I'd sit in these rooms. Now, mind you, I'm on the street, I'm homeless, I am pathetic, right? But I'm still this tough girl, you know, like, you can't tell me anything, and I judge everybody. Too old, their story isn't nothing like mine, I'm judging everybody, I can't relate. And all the yets that they talk about, you know, when I finally landed in these rooms, I'd done all the yets and created many of my own, and thank God for that. Because I have nothing inside me that thinks, oh, maybe it'll be different. There's nothing inside me that has any desire to drink or use today because of my bottom. So I'm grateful for my bottom. And it's a relation point with the people that I sponsor. You know, when I sponsor women and they're like, oh, you don't understand, I'll be like, try me. So today I know that my story was supposed to be exactly what it is so I can inspire other women, so I can help other women. There is nothing they can tell me that I'm going to say, oh, yeah, yeah, you should probably get loaded because I couldn't get over that. There's nothing. So here, one day, I'm getting sober now, you guys. So one day, I call my, no. The guy who had claimed me as his own out there on the street, he would try to force me to sell his drugs. And he was very dangerous. He was very violent. And I couldn't say no. And so this one night, I smoked all his drugs. The next day, I knew he was going to come back, and it was going to be bad. So I called my mom, because she had said, if you ever want to get clean and sober, call me, and I will help you. So I called, Mom, I'm ready to get clean and sober. I'm ready. So she came, and right when she was coming, he came, and he was dragging me into the back room, and I knew that I had to get away from him. So I managed to get away from him, and I jumped in the car, and she took me to a recovery home up in Seattle. And, you know, I was terrified. I had so much trauma. I was terrified. But I knew he would not look for me in a recovery home. You know, I knew he wouldn't look for me there. So a month or two later, after I wanted to leave the state because I was so scared of this person. So I heard from my counselor that there was really good recovery in Palm Springs. So good alcoholic that I am, I'm thinking Palm Springs. I'm thinking, oh, movie stars and, you know, palm trees and glamour. And not that I could relate to any of that, but my mind was like, yeah, let's go there. So I went down to Palm Springs, and I remember getting out of the plane. At the time, the planes weren't connected to the terminal. Like, you had to walk across the pavement to get to the terminal. And it was middle of summer. It was July or August. Now, mind you, I'm super cool, right? I'm still cool despite all my stuff. I'm like, I got my baggy jeans on and my boots, and I have my hat on backwards, and then my army duffel bag full of everything that I owned on my back. And I step off the plane, and I look at the pavement, and it's moving. And when I was out there up for weeks, the world would do that. And that's what happens when you're up for weeks. And I'm like, I am stone cold sober, and I've finally arrived in hell. And it was horrible. I was sweating. I was so upset. So I get in. My mom had paid for a month at a recovery home in Desert Hot Springs, which is hell's sister for sure. And we're driving up there, and there's tumbleweeds blowing by, and I'm like, what have I done? But, you know, I have no answers to my life. I had done everything I could to destroy myself, and there was something inside me, some flicker, and I look back at that person who I was terrified of, and he's my Eskimo. He drove me into sobriety this last time, and I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful. So I went up to Desert Hot Springs, and I proceeded within the first 2 weeks to break every rule they had, because I was clean and sober, but that's all I was. I was breaking rules because I had this chip on my shoulder, and I thought, my mom paid for a month. I should be able to do what I want. And they said, no, pack your shit. And so I had to leave. So I was in the middle of Desert Hot Springs, in the middle of summer, nowhere to go. And within that 2 weeks, I found out I was pregnant with the dude who I just left's baby. And it was very interesting, because I know now that that's when God really stepped in. This is when I look back. I didn't know at the time. But something inside me said, get to a payphone. Some of you young people probably don't know what that is. I had some change in my pocket, and I went and I looked up the hotline, AA hotline, and I called and I found a meeting. And I got on a bus, and I went to a meeting. And I can remember walking in, and I'm sweaty, and I'm pissed. I have no idea where I am. I have no idea what I'm going to do. And I'm sitting there, and my hand raises, and I did not raise my own hand. I did not raise my own hand. And I start sharing. They call on me. I start sharing, and I start crying, and I start telling you the truth about what's going on with my life. And as soon as I was done, the voice was there. What the hell did you just do? Just on me. So I get up and I sit outside, because again, I have nowhere to go. And I'm sitting outside, and the voice is so loud, and I feel so just done. I don't know what to do. And after the meeting, you know what happened. You guys all came out. Yep. Thanks for sharing. And keep coming back. All the stuff. And you know, and I'd heard this before when I'd been in and out of recovery. But before, I'd be like, in my mind, you know, F you. I didn't believe you were. I didn't believe anything you said. But for some reason, there was just a spark of humility. There was a spark of openness within me that was receptive to what you had to say for a moment. And someone at that meeting said, you know, there's this recovery home called the ABC Club in India, which is the sister of both of these places. And they said they take pregnant women. And so we called up and they accepted me. And I went to India. And I'll tell you what, I was not happy. I was pissed. I didn't know what I was gonna do. But I knew that I couldn't go back to Seattle and I didn't want to be loaded. And I don't know when that happened exactly, but I didn't want to be loaded. And the other thing is, I'm not going to apologize, but I like to tell this part of my story. It's graphic and it's brutal, but it's some of you women will relate to it. I wanted to have this baby. Now, mind you, I'd never wanted kids. I didn't think I was going to see 30, and I certainly didn't want kids. But when this baby, when she came to me, I knew that I had to have this child. Because when I was out there, I had been pregnant, and I had miscarried several times. And I can remember when I was out there and it would happen, I would just be pissed because now I have to go to the hospital and I can't get high. And the child before this one, I had a stillborn child at 5.5 months, a little boy. And I was in the hospital dealing drugs out of my hospital bed. And I had no connection with me, with the babies, with anything. I didn't have connection with anything. I was so black inside. And so when I found out that I'd probably gotten pregnant right around the time I got sober, close, I really believed that God had forgiven me. I'm like, I'm supposed to have this child. Now, mind you, I didn't know how I was going to take care of this child because I had no idea how to take care of myself. I was feral. I was feral. I was dark. So at 6 months, my water breaks in the TV room. And I knew it was too soon. You know, I knew it was too soon. I'd been put on complete bed rest for the last 3 months of my pregnancy because I'd done so much damage to my body. They're like, you're not going to be able to hold this baby. So I lasted 2 weeks and my water broke. And I was only 25 weeks clean. Pregnant. So they jammed me up to Loma Linda because they had a NICU up there. And my baby was born, emergency C-section, and she was 1.7 pounds. And for the next 4 months, I was the director of the recovery home. Danny Leahy would drive me up there. And I'd look at her in this incubator, and she was this big. She was 13 inches when she was born, and she was attached to all these machines, and she was... And sometimes I would pray, God, please just let her live. Please, I'm, you know. And other times I'd be like, God, you should take her. God, please take her. Because I was terrified. How am I going to take care of this little fragile being? So anyway, at 4 months, she got released. She was like 5 pounds. And I had just gotten kicked out of the ABC Club for threatening another resident. Because, you know, I was clean and sober, but we don't change overnight. And I am a very, very slow learner. It has taken years to grow in a lot of areas. And the rage and the anger, the very first saviors, my saviors in the beginning, were the hardest things to get rid of. Because the obsession had been lifted, but the rage was right there to take its place. And so when they kicked me out, because I was going to, anyway, they kicked me, I didn't know what was going to happen to my baby. You know, one day we'd talk to the doctors, and they'd be like, she gained 2 ounces, and they'd announce it over the loudspeaker, Rashina gained 2 ounces, and the whole place would, yay, and the next day she lost 4. So it was this roller coaster, And, you know, and I'm raw because I'm newly sober and I'm working the steps and I'm trying to do all this stuff. And I tell you what, it is a miracle, again, that we stay sober when we do the steps. And that mirror, that gets, faces us. And I realize that I am responsible for my life. I cannot blame my dad's alcoholism, because I found out he was an alcoholic, for my choices. Now, mind you, I didn't know I had a choice when I was out there. I was so gone. I was just so pulled around by my disease. I didn't know I had a choice. So when we come in here and we do the steps and we get to the fourth step and we're doing the fifth step, it's amazing that we stay here. If we work an honest and thorough one, because that's what saved my life. When I'd been in recovery before, I'd done the steps, but there were certain things I was going to go to my grave with. I was not going to share them. And this time I let it all out. And my sponsor, I'll never forget. So my sponsor, we were doing the fifth step, and she had this room that she'd have for her sponsees, and there was a bed. It was very comfortable. And we were laying down on the bed, and I was sharing my fifth step, and I was dying inside. Like, I knew at any moment, as soon as she heard something that I said, she was gonna be gone, Reese. I don't want you in my life. But she didn't do that. Whenever I shared something super dark, she'd hug me and she'd tell me one of her stories, and she'd say, I love you. And she was affectionate. And it was the first time that I'd had that true, unconditional affection from another woman. Unconditional. And I'm so grateful for that woman today. She helped me see that even though I was powerless over my disease, I am not powerless over my recovery, and that I can stay sober one day at a time if I'm honest. If I'm honest. And in my honesty brings humility and it brings vulnerability, all these things that I never wanted, because those things, when you're out there, make you weak. They make you prey. And so I had this armor around me, and once I started softening up, again, years, it took years, but I realized that's what true power is. Humility, gratitude, vulnerability, that's power. Not this, you know, this attitude like that. That's weakness. That was my weakness. That's what kept me so sick. So anyway, I get kicked out, and they give me a call, I can come get my baby. So I went up to Seattle, and I stayed there for a while, and then came back. And, you know, because of my connections in these rooms, there was a sober woman who I could rent a room from, and that's what I did. And there was a program, vocational rehabilitation, that paid for my schooling, because anybody who was mentally ill or, you know, alcoholic, whatever, they pay for your schooling, and they paid for my daycare. And so for a year, I went to cosmetology school, and it's kind of funny because at the time, I didn't even know what size pants I wore, because I wore everything baggy, you know? I didn't wear makeup. I'd never worn heels. And I saw all these girls in this cosmetology school, and there's a lot of cholas in there that thought they were bad. And I would just, in my mind, I'd be like, you have no idea who I am. But I didn't leave. I went every day, 8 hours a day, for a year. And I got my license, my cosmetology license. And slowly I started to be comfortable with being a woman, a young woman. I slowly started to fit my skin a little bit, but it took many years. You know, I had friends in recovery. There was a group of us young people that hung together, and some of the girls in there, they would want to dress me and put makeup on me, and I'd look in the mirror, and it was like I was in drag. I'd look in the mirror, and I'm like, that's not me. And so again, it took so many years for me to find myself and to be comfortable with myself and to talk respectful and to not be ghetto and to, now mind you, there's a time and a place for that sometimes. And I'm okay with that too. You know, I can come and put makeup on and dress nice, or I can wear my baggy pants and wear my hats, and it doesn't matter today, because what matters is I'm whole inside me. I'm whole inside me. So I got my degree, and I started working, and, you know, I ended up moving down to San Diego, and I worked in Coronado for like 20 years, and I had this little girl, Rashina, And she was dragged to meetings every day with me. I had a meeting at my house in Coronado for like 8 years. And so she was raised in recovery. She was raised in these rooms. But my daughter, I can remember when people would smoke and she would sometimes grab their cigarette and scrunch it up. And I'd be like, you can't do that. And she's like, it's bad for you. And she left at 18. And she was loaded. I didn't really know how much she was doing, but she left at 18. And she got sober at 19 for a year, probably the best year I've ever had with her. And since she was diagnosed with bipolar 1 and with psychotic features when she was 23 after being out and after she had her daughter. And she's been out ever since. She's 33 years old. My sobriety date is June 15th, 1992. Miracle. But this is one thing that I know. My sobriety will not save my child. My sobriety will not save anybody else. I've seen my sister died of this disease. That younger sister that I had, she died of this disease. My dad died of this disease. My aunt, my cousin died of this disease. I can't save anyone else. I can only be an example of recovery and whoever is supposed to be within my orbit to get whatever I have to share, then that's God's will. That's God's will. And you know, I'm there for my daughter, I don't want to get emotional. You know, the disease is one thing. Mental illness is so extra. It's so extra. And so she had a son. He's 7 years old now, and her daughter is 9, who lives with her father. And at 8 months old, CPS called me and asked if I wanted to get my grandson. And without a thought, of course I'm going to get my grandson. And I ended up adopting him, and so I've had him all these years. And it's a miracle. It's a miracle. Thank you. Everything I've learned in this program, the community that I've become a part of, that I immerse myself within, helps me be a parent to this little boy, helps me be a grandparent to my granddaughter, helps me connect them so they can have a sibling relationship. And I wouldn't have had any of this if I wouldn't have gotten sober and stayed sober. Now, I'm not gonna lie, I'm still super sensitive. The thoughts in my head can get loud. Those feelings can get overwhelming. But today I have tools that I learned here that makes the noise not so loud. I know how to turn down the volume. I know how to meditate and pray. I know how to reach out to a newcomer. I know how to do the steps in this program and in other programs. Because there's a lot of 12 programs that have dealt, that help me with things that I suffer from. Thank God for the 12 steps. So my father, when I was about almost 8 years sober, I knew he lived in Ensenada. He'd moved down there with his wife. And I decided, well, I was on a women's recovery cruise, and I'd gone down there, and I mentioned to someone that my dad lived down there, and they're, oh, you're going to see him? And I'm like, no, why would I see him? I'd tried to reach out to him over the years, and he always had an excuse why I couldn't see him. And he always, I'm going out of town. That was his favorite. I'm going out of town. So now I was actually going to Ensenada, and someone said, well, you should call him. And it was funny because my best friend at the time, who went out at 17 years and has never been back, but she gave me the most profound, I was so open, I was so receptive to what should I do in the situation. And she says, have you ever made an amends to him? And that really pissed me off because it's like, what have I ever done to him? And this is what she said. She says, the amends isn't for him, Reese, it's for you. It's for you to get freedom. It's for your peace of mind. It's for your growth. And I said, I don't even know what to apologize for. And she said, just say, I am sorry for any harm I may have caused you in my life. So we found him, and it was funny because sure enough, he was going out of town. But he saw me before he left. And so I got to make an amends to him. And I was so open. I was so open. And I'll tell you what, when we stay open, God moves through us. If I shut myself down, and if I shut myself down to your information or to your help, or if I'm closed off and blocking myself from God, I'm on my own. And we all know how that goes. So I was so open in this moment and receptive. And when I made an amends to him, it was an absolute miracle because he turned around and he apologized to me, which is not what I expected. And then he invited me and my daughter to come down and visit him. And that was the other thing. When I was pregnant, he asked my brother what race the father was. And my brother told him he was black. And that was one reason my dad wouldn't see me. And so when he invited me and my daughter to come down, it was a miracle, you know. So we went down. And sure enough, he was going out of town because he had just been diagnosed with cancer. Liver cancer, cirrhosis, hepatitis C from his own journey. So I invited him to give me my token at the ABC Club at my home group, my 8-year token. I had no idea what he was going to do. He was sick. It was a few months before he passed. And he and his wife drove all the way to Indio to give me a token. And he was really sick, but he wore his 3-piece suit. You know, my dad was very handsome. And everybody, when he gave me a token, the whole room exploded because everybody knew my journey with my father. And he stayed through the whole meeting. He laughed at all the parts that alcoholics laugh at that normies are just horrified to hear, right? And at the end of the meeting, he told me he was proud of me. First time my dad had ever said he was proud of me. And he said, I wish I would have found this 50 years ago. And a few months later, he passed. But I got, during that time, I was down to Ensenada almost every weekend. I'd bring flowers for his wife. I'd bring them books. I'd bring them, what can I bring to you? And I realized, it's in God's time. We hear that in the program. Don't leave before the miracle happens. It's in God's time. And I realized that I needed that almost 8-year sobriety to learn how to love, to learn how to accept myself, to gain some tools. So when I saw my father, all I wanted to do was love him. I had no more resentment. It was gone. I just wanted to give him love. I wanted to give him what I had received from these rooms, from you. And you know, one of the last times that he was able, one morning when I was driving back to Indio, he told me to sit down at the table and he was gonna make me breakfast. And he made the table, the place setting all nice. And I'm like, can I help? Nope. This was his way, you know. He was very, very strong, very proud, very not real, you know, affectionate, but he made me breakfast and he served me. And I will always, always have these memories, you know. It's such a big deal. And it's such a contrast to my life. And it's such a testament. When you stay sober and you really work this thing, and you really want to be connected to your higher power, and you really want to be a loving, kind person, because that's my motto today. When I wake up, how can I be loving and kind? How can I be of service to my fellows, not only in this room, but everywhere I go? How can I be of service? What do I need to do to help someone who may need help? And so this little boy who's being raised with me gets all my tools. Yeah. The other day, so he's like me, I'd say unfortunately, but he's very emotional. He's very loud. He's very big. And I realize I'm in a unique position to help him with his feelings. And the other day I got so mad, I threw his homework on the ground and I'm like, I don't know what to do. And sent him to his room. And then of course I went in, okay, God, please just help me. And I go in there and I just told him, sometimes I don't know what to do. Mind you, he's 7. He's like, yeah, Mom, sometimes I don't know either. And he's like, let's meditate. Because we do this 5-minute meditation sometimes. And I didn't even think about it. And so we both sit across from each other and we meditated for 5 minutes. And at the end of it, you know, we give each other a big hug. And all the emotions have been diffused, and we say, I love you. And that's my life today. And it's the simple things. Yes, I've been able to travel all over the world. I've been able to do a lot of really amazing things and collect some properties and all these things. But that only happens because of what's in here. Because of what's in here. Then I attract these other things to me. We can have a big life. We can have as big as we want. But it's those simple, small moments that affect me the most deeply. It's the relationships that I've developed and that I continue to nurture in this program that save my life. So I'm really grateful that I got to share my story with you. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Eyeballs in. Boom. All right. Okay. I would like to thank Reese. I hope you come back and visit us soon. Thank you. I would also like to thank the residents of the house and the Women's Auxiliary for a fantastic dinner. Thanks very much.